Radio City, John Grayson, Rob Ross here, hanging out with you and doing some talking with a brand new camera, even though you can't see that, but trust me, we have one. And so life is good around the old radio ranch, except for the fact that the old radio ranch remains unemployed at this point. But Rob, how's everything going in New York?
It's cold. That's what it is. It's freezing here, okay? Now I can gripe in my own typical old man way about the cold, crappy weather. We went from nice, seasonable, comfortable to, all right, this is late December weather.
Yeah.
Well, and the inaccuracy, of course, of all weather people across the board saying, oh, it's going to be 58 degrees, 53 degrees. No, it's more like 28 and 33.
It is. It's the worst kind of guesswork. And nobody knows what's going to happen, least of all the people whose job it is to know. And we've had every swing you could imagine. I mean, it got brutal cold. It snowed on us a week and a half ago. And then that cleared up and we got back into the 70s, which was great. And so Thanksgiving Day and the day after were really, really nice. And then all of a sudden it crashed again. We got no snow out of this, although Kansas City got just buried. So the other side of the state, to the other side of Missouri, got really, really just buried in snow. And we got nary a flake. And yet the weather, I think this morning when my wife left for work, it was 15.
What we got was just these really cold winds. Thanksgiving itself was chilly, but again, appropriate for Thanksgiving.
Sure.
The day after, however, was just bitter cold. Not the 20s, but it was the winds that made it feel like the 20s. Today was one of those days. Again, inaccuracy. Yesterday, we got this nasty cold rainstorm. So combining the cold weather and the rain made it really, really uncomfortable. But on to more important and positive topics. How was your Thanksgiving, first and foremost?
It was great. It was exactly what we had talked about last week. Everything was very low-key. Got the bird done late by design because one of our sons was working, and so he couldn't make it over until about 7 o'clock. And then, you know, the food was served. It was great. Everybody had a wonderful time. And so how about you? How'd everything go?
In a word, perfect. Absolutely perfect. The bird was remarkable. I want to say after 20 years of marriage with Liz, this may have been our best one yet, to be very frank about it. It was just that good. We did something a little different. As we talked about, you know, Liz always makes the stuffing from scratch. And usually what she does is get three different types of loaves of bread and sets them out a day or two before to get stale. She usually goes with potato, multigrain wheat, and Canadian white, because we always shop at Trader Joe's for Thanksgiving. Instead of getting the Canadian white, instead of the multigrain, we got this year something called cranberry rustico bread.
Ooh.
And it's so out of the box delicious. It really just kicked it up even further, better than I could have ever imagined. But everything went like clockwork. The meal itself was perfect. We ate early around 1-ish or so, which was fantastic because I was out by about 5:30. Just really warm, comfortable. And this year I tried for the first time, instead of the cranberry orange relish that you and I talked about, I went with the cranberry sauce. And I think I've got a new addiction because Trader Joe's cranberry sauce wins.
Really? Trader Joe's damn near anything wins. Let's be honest about it.
Unbelievable. It's just always a win every time we go. And the thing is with the cranberry sauce, it's these huge juicy cranberries that just pop and explode and it's so good. So good. So it was a perfect Thanksgiving. Everything I wanted it to be and then some. So
good for you. Well, and there are some other things going on as well. One guy who definitely did not have a happy Thanksgiving, and this story, I swear to you, I have never seen something that happened half a world away like this grow such legs in terms of longevity for a story. Now, granted, a kid died in this. I say kid. He was 27 years old, I think. But I'm talking about this guy, this missionary, who showed up on this island in the middle of nowhere in the Indian Ocean where nobody is allowed to go. You're not supposed to go there. And the government keeps you out, and the Indian government, you know, patrols the seas around there to make sure nobody goes near it. Because the few people who live on this island called North Sentinel Island, they hate everybody from the outside. They have their own language. They have their own system of law. They have their own everything. It is a self-contained, primitive society. And the one thing that we know about them is they hate everybody from outside. So along comes this Christian missionary as young guy who is taken by boat near the island, has to canoe over to it, and is immediately repelled by people shooting arrows at him and all this stuff. Comes back a day later, tries again. This time, they shoot arrows at him, smash his canoe, and make him swim back to the fishing boat. And then day three, he comes back again. And guess what happens? They kill him. So now the whole world has gone nuts over this story. And for the life of me, I can't understand why. It's one dumbass who did something he knew was going to end up with him dead. And he ended up dead. Shocking.
Where was he from?
Here. Yeah, now here in the States somewhere. I think on the East Coast, but I could be wrong on that.
What was the motivation?
He wanted to convert them all to Christianity.
File that under you get what you deserve.
Yes. And now there's this Christian rights group that came out and they said, oh, this is another example of Christians being oppressed. And I thought, no, he was going there to destroy their religion. If anybody's guilty of religious oppression, I think it's the missionary.
Yeah, somebody needs to tell them the whole concept of, quote, Christian oppression is a media created shuck and jive for the years that the Christians oppressed everybody else. Now, I will say this much. There is a lot of unnecessary – because any kind of religious oppression in the United States by and large is ridiculous.
Right.
Because that's why we have freedom of religion here. However, one person, one lone nut holding a Bible and a sword in his hand saying, I'm going to convert all of you. You're asking for trouble.
Yeah.
You're walking into the proverbial lion's den. And you come from a civilized modern world. This isn't the 1800s. It's that simple.
Well, I think it depends who you ask. There's a lot of people in the South who still think it's 1859.
Well, that we're not going to start licking mud at our friends in the South. We like our friends south of the Mason-Dixon line. I'm fond of the people of the South. I have a very warm spot in my heart for them. And I hope that, you know, when I finally arrive down there and migrate my way down, because as a tired, angry New Yorker, you know, I will find a place to live comfortably.
The people that I like in the South, and there are many of them, are the ones who realize that those idiots are making the rest of them look bad.
I know. And the problem is the media yet again. Fake news, fake news. The media, of course, loves to paint the picture of every Southerner is stupid. The smartest people I've come to know over the course of my life, a major portion of them are all Southerners.
Yep.
I really find it to be a reprehensible. But then again, it's the typical feeding into stereotypes. You know, every Jew has a big nose, is beady-eyed, shifty, and likes – well, I like money, but that's not the point.
Right.
We can sniff a penny a mile away. Hang on a second. I see some money on the floor. I'll be right back.
All New Yorkers are rude assholes. Yeah, right. It's the same thing.
I'll tell you something. This and I'm glad you brought that up because I had to go very briefly into the city on Friday, on Black Friday. Everywhere I went, especially in the ferry terminal, and I was in transit for all of a total of an hour going and coming back.
Yeah.
That was all the time it took. But it felt like an eternity because it was wall-to-wall asshole tourists. Tourists who come to New York are the rudest people I've ever encountered.
Oh, no doubt.
Anywhere I've gone in my life, people have always been incredibly kind and patient and helpful and lovely, and it doesn't matter what neighborhoods I wound up in. When people say, oh my God, you were in that neighborhood of Atlanta? Yeah, and the people were terrific. I asked where the buses were. They pointed me to the right bus and said, don't take that one. Take the one right behind it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But tourists who come to New York, for whatever reason, are in complete and utter dick mode, and it doesn't matter where they're from, if they're fellow Americans or Europeans. They're just a bunch of douchebags.
Right. Well, you know where it comes from. I mean, the idea that New Yorkers are all rude and, you know, it's a very simple thing. And having been there, you get sort of inured to it because you end up in part of the same rhythm that everybody else is in. And it's not so much that New Yorkers are rude. It's that they don't have any time. You know, everybody's busy, man. It's like, imagine yourself, and this is because the pace of life is so different. When I moved out of New York and moved to Florida, it was a time shift that it took me years to adjust to. That idea that, yeah, you know, we'll get around to it whenever, man. That doesn't happen there. And if you catch somebody on the street and say, how do I get to the Statue of Liberty? That dude does not have time, you know, to sit there and tell you and give you directions and, you know, and point to the Statue of Liberty and get you there. You know, you can't do that in a city like New York where there's shit going on all the time.
Well, here's what really chafed me. I was sitting on the ferry coming back, and this was a bitter cold day. And these assholes plopped themselves down and opened the window so they could lean out and look at and take pictures of the Statue of Liberty. And the winds are blowing, and there's this family sitting there that, you know, that were going home. You know, you can tell they were from my neighborhood.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have a child with them, and the child's freezing. And I said, excuse me, the wind is blowing in. It's really cold. There's a family sitting over there with a small child. I'm sitting right here by the window. You know, the very least you could have done was ask.
Right, right.
You know, and they're like, oh, we want to take a picture. I'm like, well, wait until the boat approaches the statue, take your picture, and then close the window. And on the other side of me were these other assholes who just leaned out the entire way. I'm like, God, I hope you freeze. I hope the rest of your trip is horrible. You people are dicks.
Well, the thing is, there's a deck. If you really want to get the picture of the Statue of Liberty that bad, haul your ass out onto the deck and freeze out there and take your picture.
I sit on the bottom level to avoid these assholes,
right?
Because they can go upstairs.
Yep.
But no, these douchebags were everywhere, and they were all fucking Europeans. So let's send them back. Now let's talk a little bit more about the whole weekend and the concept of it, because binge watching is a thing that's, you know, happening across our great land.
Yep.
And everyone's into it. Now, the one thing about the holiday weekend is that it wasn't – I don't think this was binge watching so much as it was there were numerous intriguing and entertaining marathons on the air. Case in point, A&E was showing marathons of live PD, right? MTV, of course, had marathons of Jersey Shore. I found myself watching – this is the one that I really twigged, and I've come to the conclusion that I genuinely like this show. I started watching the Leah Remini show on A&E about Scientology.
Oh, it's excellent. Yeah.
Now, I want to preface this by saying I have been smitten with her since I first laid eyes on her. First of all, she's from here.
Yeah.
So, you know, and she's a goddess to begin with. But I adore her even more now. And I genuinely found myself like feeling the effects of like watching the show and the emotions that people are going through. And it's an incredible and powerful series. Most importantly, it's really intelligent. It pulls no punches. I believe every single word that everybody who's come on to give their testimonials, everything they say, I know to be true.
Right.
And I just absolutely find – I think I might find Scientologists even more deplorable than Trump supporters, because at least with Trump supporters, you know what you're going to get.
Right.
You know, it's very clear cut. It's like the whole people up in arms now about the rise of anti-Semitism, and we're going to get to that in a minute or so, in the United States, and they're all trying to lay it at the feet of the right. No, they've always been there.
Yep.
Nothing's ever changed about those guys. It's the anti-Semites on the left. They're the ones who have the louder voices because they're trying to do it in the name of rationality and Palestinians.
Yeah.
Which neither – those are mutually exclusive things. Rationality and Palestinians do not go hand in hand. Now, getting back to that show though, I think it is – it's important that people watch it because – it is a very good handbook if you have kids who are going through their own emotional upheaval. Kids wind up in cults. I'm sorry, but kids are the fodder for cults.
Oh, yeah.
And the best way you could possibly avoid that ever happening is to watch what happens when you hear the backstories of how people got involved with something like Scientology. Those people are so repugnant. I can't even find the words because we'd be here all night with me just going on a profanity-laced tirade where I'd be spitting and nearly apoplectic, and there's no point to that. But what I want to say is the show is terrific. Tonight starts the third season. Watch it.
Yeah.
And go back and watch the first two seasons on A&E On Demand.
Well, it also – and I'm glad to know that they did indeed do a third season because it was kind of up in the air there for a while. In fact, they had only ever planned on doing one. And it was so successful and so powerful that they said, okay, let's go ahead and do a second season of this. And now they're on number three, which is great because she's doing a wonderful job. There are still the British guy that she's with co-hosting the show. Still something about that guy I don't trust.
You know, it's funny. He was like the number three guy.
Right, right.
He's actually Australian, and he was the, quote, envoy that tried to get Scientology reestablished in Australia, where it was banned.
Okay.
But
Mike something or other, but yeah.
Mike Rinder.
Yep.
Rinder. And when he left, he was kind of, an island by himself. But when Paul Haggis left, that made everything turn around for him. And that's why, the movie Going Clear happened.
Yeah.
And so, I think the work that they're doing is vital and important. There was one episode in particular that was in the first season or the second, I'm not sure, but she reconnects with two of her closest friends from her youth.
Yes.
Who had left at various points, and she had, disconnected from, to use the parlance of Scientology terms. And that episode ended – now you've seen it, so you know what happens. That episode ended with one of her friends getting a text from her mother who had disconnected from her. And the shocker was in the next episode, her mother left.
Yep.
So they reunited. Very, very powerful stuff. Very, very powerful. And I think the work that they're doing is good work, and it's important work, and they're to be commended and applauded, respected and appreciated for doing it.
Right. Well, and with all of the talk that we've had about anniversaries, usually musical, because this was just last week was the 50th anniversary of the release of the White Album, et cetera, et cetera. The one anniversary that passed by with almost zero notice whatsoever was last week. It was 45 years, believe it or not, since Jamestown. Or Jonestown, rather. The Jonestown Massacre in Guyana.
No.
Yes.
40 years.
You're right, I'm sorry. 40, remember, yeah, it was 1978.
I remember 78, yeah, I remember it vividly. I do. But, it's funny, with all the anniversaries that have passed us by, we forgot to mention it. It's the 50th anniversary of Stax's liberation from Atlantic Records, and the transition from the, Stax of Wax to the Finger Snap when they became their own thing.
Right.
But that's a happy anniversary that we should definitely celebrate later on. Jonestown was. I remember it so clearly because actually that's when my cousin was born. But I remember the massacre at the airport when Leo Ryan and the people that came with him, including people from NBC News,
right,
were all shot to death at the airport in a really cowardly way, might I add, because they were being brought back to the airport and then they were massacred before they could get on the plane. And then what? A day or so later, the mass suicides happened.
Yeah, it was that night. Yeah, and it was – I interviewed a guy who was part of the cleanup crew, and to even have to call them that, it sounds horribly insulting considering what these guys had to deal with. But imagine that. I mean, you've got hundreds of dead bodies laying out in the sun in the middle of a jungle in Guyana, and they're flying these guys down on C-130s, and they've got nothing but body bags stacked floor to ceiling, and their job is to get all of these bodies and bring them back so that they can be buried. And so they're surrounded by nothing but death and flies and smell and the knowledge of what happened there for weeks. And I mean, the number of people who were part of that cleanup crew who suffered some level of PTSD has got to be damn near 100%.
Also, November 22nd was, I believe, the 55th anniversary since the assassination of JFK.
That's right. November 22nd, 1963.
Where were you? I wasn't born yet.
Nor was I. So
that's like saying, it's one of those moments, where were you when Kennedy was killed? Where were you when the Beatles landed? Well, I wasn't even excitement yet in my parents' eyes. So,
I don't even know. Yeah, my parents, I guess, had met by then, but I don't know that they were. I know they weren't married yet. They didn't get married until 64.
I think I was conceived around the time when the Beatles had the five spots on the Billboard chart.
Right.
Because I came along and the Beatles were actually number one. The number one single when I was born was I Feel Fine. So
nice.
Stick that in your hearts. That's right.
Yeah. See, I wasn't even around for the moon landing. I missed that one by a couple of months.
Wait, were you even born when the Beatles were together?
Well, it depends on when you call the breakup. Is it when
it's officially April 10th, 1970, when
then,
the
yes.
news got out when Paul had left.
That Paul had left, right. Because if you counted from Ringo, then no.
No. It was an official announcement.
Right. Okay. So, yeah, I was around. I was born in September of 69.
All right, so you were born in time for the World Series victory of the Maze?
The 69 Mets, that's right.
Okay, good enough.
All right.
And I'll let you pass on that one.
Good deal. So, yeah, I mean, it is. It's funny to, you know, to kind of look back on this stuff. And what I remember the most about, because I would have been 9 years old when Guyana happened. And so I remember vaguely some of the news coverage. But what really sticks with me is that a year or two later, there was a TV, you know, made for TV movie called Guyana Tragedy. And I remember the day that it was on. I mean, it was one of those events kind of like the day after. Not quite that big a deal, but it was still one of those TV events that everybody was talking about. You know, it goes, in my lifetime, it goes Helter Skelter, Guyana Tragedy, the day after.
It's funny. The day after was Thanksgiving weekend, 35 years ago.
Yep, 83.
It's around Thanksgiving they do these shitty movies to us, you know?
Yeah. Good old Jason Robards sitting there ducking the nukes.
In the car, yeah. You know, those flash freeze frames where people are just lixivated.
See, now, you know? if I had produced that, I would have at least used Pink Floyd's Two Suns in the Sunset as background music while all of that was going on. But no, we can't maybe, have nice
because
things.
Because we boycott Pink Floyd. No, we can't have Pink Floyd. We
right. Oh man. So what else is going on? As we're doing, we should mention this. We didn't even mention this at the outset that we're doing yet another in our occasional series of complete ad-libbed shows.
Right. We decided, you know, it was a holiday week. We're in a festive mood. You know, we're just looking around. The world just seems to be running themselves into the ground with just more and more misery. Everything is so negative.
Yep.
You know, the energy has been sapped from everyone. I understand it, but I'm tired of being dragged down, and I don't want us to have to keep doing reportage where we're just going to be sitting here getting angry while we do it. Yeah, I want to be angry in a good way. I want to be justified in my anger. You know, I want to be able to say, oh, look at this. The New York Rangers actually blanked the New York Islanders with Lundqvist not in goal the night before Thanksgiving, and then they cough it up with Lundqvist in goal on Friday against the Flyers,
right,
for nothing, you know, and then lose again with Lundqvist in goal to the Capitals the next day. That's the kind of anger I want to have.
Well, see, and going back to what you said before, I once knew a girl who loved to do it when she was angry, but that's another story altogether. And on the subject of hockey,
would you consider that kind of bench fuck? Or is that...
No, it's just, you know, grudge fuck maybe, but
hate sex can be, I mean, you know, kids, one of these days we're going to have to do this show because, you know, we're good at bringing up personal anecdotes. And I did date someone who was just angry all the time.
Uh-huh.
So maybe our entire relationship, which was incredibly sexual on every possible level, was just pure anger.
Well,
I was in great shape afterwards, though, let me tell you.
Well, let's...
With great shape.
Yeah, so let's take the safe route back to hockey then. And
hockey.
Yeah, right, exactly. Let me bring up the fact that my Buffalo Sabres tonight, as it's Tuesday night as we're recording this, are going for victory number 10 in a row. I'm not just talking about an unbeaten streak. I mean a winning streak. 9 games in a row, and for a time they were atop the NHL in points.
Anybody who does that is okay in my book.
Yeah.
By the way, I do want to say this. Up until that disaster on Friday, the Rangers actually had the best record in the NHL from mid-October to mid-November.
Wow.
That shocks me.
Yeah.
It really does, in a good way. And I still say no thanks to Lundqvist. I watched him last night. Now, the Rangers won the game, okay? They beat Ottawa 4-2. Of course, he gave up a goal in the last minute as they were trying to go for, you know, but, and it was totally his fault, but I'm watching him, the puck hits his glove, and instead of just grabbing it,
yeah,
he lets it deflect, and he's looking around instead of watching the puck, and it could have easily bounced right in front of the guy from Ottawa, but luckily, one of his defensemen just came swooping in and knocked it away, luckily.
Yeah.
But no, they did win last night's game, but it wasn't a good win in the sense of, okay, Lundqvist didn't have to stand on his head. He did, by his own fault.
Yeah. Well,
he's throwing off in the net, and people seem to still buy it.
Right. Meanwhile, by the way, the game is going on as we speak, and the Sabres are ahead of San Jose 1-0 at the end of two. So who knows? They may get that 10th win in a row.
So I'm presuming this is in Buffalo.
They are playing, yes. Yeah, the Sabres are in dark, so yeah. Now, on Sunday, with the Bills in the Jacksonville game, did you see any of the fight?
I heard about it. Now, was the guy who slapped the ball, so to speak, was he hurt in the process?
No. What happened was he had a long pass. And when I say long pass, 35 yards somewhere in that neighborhood. And it was one of those rainbows that hit right in the corner, between the 1 yard line and the end zone. So you've got a receiver who goes up for the ball, a defender who goes up for the ball, and they both grab it at the same time. Now, in that case, quite rightly, they assign the ball to the offense. A tie always goes to the receiver. So while these two guys are on the ground, and neither one of them wanted to release their grip on the ball, thinking that that mattered. But the play had already been called as a catch and, down at the 1 yard line. Actually, it was called a touchdown, but they reversed it because the guy's butt hit. So while all of that was going on, these two guys are just laying there on the ground, both with their arms around the football. Neither one of them wants to let go. And then, the tensions had been rising throughout the game, and it boiled over, and Leonard Fournette, running back for Jacksonville, who was the only one up until that point who was doing anything for them offensively, walked up and started slapping at one of Buffalo's defensive linemen. Now, this is a running back slapping a defensive lineman, and both of them are in full pads. It was the dumbest thing I've ever seen. And then, by the way, both of them got ejected. And on that drive, even though Jacksonville had the ball first and goal on the one, they tried running it, which would have been Fournette had he not gotten ejected the play before. Didn't get in. Second down, penalty. Back they go. Third down, sack. And then they try a field goal and miss. So instead of getting a touchdown, which would have put them up by 7, they ended up with 0 points out of that drive.
Well, that's justice for you.
Yep.
In a word.
And the Bills won. Yep.
And the Jets lost. But hey, you know what? I expected that, especially against the Patriots. Although the Jets showed up, they went toe-to-toe with the Patriots till halftime. After halftime, they just kind of said, okay, well, we showed up at least. The Giants, on the other hand, just lost in the most embarrassing fashion to the mediocre Eagles on the very last play of the game.
Uh-huh.
By a field goal. Well, there you go. The legend of Eli Manning is in the toilet. I have no beefs with Eli, but for all my Giant-loving friends, ha!
Exactly. And I feel the same way, because Eli Manning embarrassed Tom Brady in the Super Bowl twice. So I will always have a special place in my heart for Eli Manning. But yeah, when the Giants lose, especially like that, I get the same reaction.
Well, that's the thing is, the Giants fans are like Yankees fans.
Yep.
But they always tend to go the same way. Mets, Jets, Rangers, Knicks, and then Yankees, Giants. And to me, it's all the same meatheads right across the board, yeah. Dead from the neck up, So, that was my Sunday in sport, which is fine because, hey, I had better things to do on Sunday anyway.
Yeah.
I had a fabulous brunch with a friend of mine, which was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful atmosphere. First time I found a place in Brooklyn in almost 2 years that I really liked. Food was amazing. Incredible Bloody Marys. And great music, great atmosphere, great conversation. So nice. It was a perfect way to cap off the nice long weekend.
Yeah. Where we had, starting on Thursday and going all the way through, they released the new season of Mystery Science Theater 3000 on Netflix. And they did it in a way that was, where you were encouraged to binge it throughout the day on Thanksgiving. We didn't. But, you can watch it episodically as well. So we've been doing that. We're now 3 episodes in to a 6-episode release on Netflix. And it's fantastic. And, I'm a fan of this show. I've been a fan of this show since the very first time I ever saw it. So it would be hard for me to really get down on it. But the one thing that I think they cleaned up from last season, which was the first one with Jonah and the new guys and all of that stuff, to this season, is that the pacing is better. It's a little more laid back. It's a little more comfortable. I think when they did this last season, they had a tendency to kind of rush everything. And all of the jokes, they jammed too many of them into each episode, and there was no space there. The old TV show on Comedy Central and Sci-Fi Network was very laid back. They would do 700 jokes in a show, but they had 90 minutes to, of airtime to do that. So, it wasn't just bang, 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 make a joke about everything. And I think they learned a lot from last season. They were, those were good episodes. These, so far, the first three that we watched are outstanding.
Well, now, you're bringing up something comedic, and we're going to transition from comedy into cartoons because a little sad news came our way today. Steven Hillenburg, who created SpongeBob SquarePants, passed away.
Yeah.
It turns out he had been diagnosed back in the spring with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, the most vicious, vindictive disease on the planet. Mm-hmm. I mean, I swear to God, if I was ever, God forbid, diagnosed with that, I would off myself immediately because I wouldn't be able to conceive the idea of what it's going to do.
Right.
But that's very, very sad to hear. I actually love SpongeBob SquarePants. It's the perfect thing. You never have to take LSD. All you have to do is just watch SpongeBob. It is the trippiest, most bizarre cartoon on the planet. It's hysterical. It's memorable. I love SpongeBob. I love the first SpongeBob movie.
Well, yeah, I do too. Well, I thought the Twisted Sister routine was fantastic. It was hilarious, and to hear that music coming out on a SpongeBob cartoon was just perfect. And I love it because its heart is in the right place, and it always has been. They didn't start that. Now, granted, it sounds a little weird to say, but they didn't start that show thinking, we're going to merchandise the hell out of this and we're all going to get filthy, stinking rich. That happened, but it happened organically. People bought that stuff and bought the dolls and the stickers and all of that stuff because the characters were great, because the writing was funny, because it was intelligent. It didn't insult you. It has a charm about it that's undeniable. So it happened the right way, and then they got rich. Good for them. That's called winning.
But the thing is that you just struck the biggest chord of all. It's a funny show. It's just downright hilarious it doesn't beat you over the head the way Family Guy does. I mean, I used to find Family Guy funny. Now I find it tiresome, so I don't watch it anymore. But SpongeBob always made me laugh. Plus, the characters, you get into the characters and their whole story, like the whole thing with what's his name? What's the name of the one-eyed barnacle, the annoying character, the one that hates SpongeBob?
Shit.
What is he, like a barnacle or something like that?
Oh, man, the one who's always trying to steal the recipe for the Krusty Krab.
Right, he wants the secret sauce for the Krabby Patties.
I can remember every other name on that show, and I can't remember his, but I know who you're talking about.
He's hilarious.
Right.
He's one of the funniest things about the show because everything he does is wrong.
Plankton.
Thank you, Plankton. Yes. To me, the episode, probably because it was the first episode I ever watched in its entirety, is the episode where SpongeBob adopts a baby clam.
Yeah,
I mean, it's hysterical.
Right.
It's hysterical and it's bizarre. Patrick is one of the funniest retarded characters ever to come along. But they're also very sweet characters because they're so well-meaning.
Right.
That's the part that people forget. There's nothing vindictive in this. That's, it's easy for you and I to talk about, on, let's say for argument's sake, the wabbit and the duck going at it with a sledgehammer and a shovel, or blasting each other in the face with a shotgun. There's nothing mean-spirited in this. It's just a funny, well-written, great voices throughout.
Yep.
It's, like I said, it's hysterical, but you never need LSD. Just watch five or six episodes of this and you're tripping.
On the other hand, and I'm glad you brought this up because this is one of those things that's been rattling around in my head now for a while. And I was trying to determine exactly when it all went wrong, because up until a certain point in my childhood, They were rolling out still new Hanna-Barbera cartoons all the time. They were Warner Brothers had kind of really laid off by then, and they were just rehashing old Bugs Bunny stuff repackaged. But still, you know, it was quality stuff, so they had good source material. But there were new things coming along, and they did, you know, the Laugh Olympics was a big deal right around 1975, 76. And then they started doing new series, and there were two of them that I remembered thinking, okay, this should be funny, and yet I just can't get it. So when was the time that cartoons, the funny ones, I'm not talking about the space chase ones that were designed to make us buy toys. I mean, the ones that were supposed to be funny, when did they lose you?
I want to say around 1978. I can pinpoint it, actually. It was when I was starting eighth grade. It was the last time I ever watched, you know how we talked about when they would do the Friday night specials on CBS, ABC, and NBC of what's starting right tomorrow or next week for your Saturday morning blockbusters? The first whiff I got of, I don't like this, was, I don't know if you remember him, Mumbly.
Yes.
Mumbly, for those who don't remember, was the bastardization, or they later called him the cousin.
A rehash.
Muttley, of course, we know was kind of a tannish dog with black. We all know who Muttley is, but if you don't remember what he looks like, he's got black ears, tannish, always wears an old-fashioned racing helmet and goggles no matter what series he's in.
Yep.
He always looks like he walked out of the Wacky Races regardless. And you all know his laugh. It was Paul Winchell who did the voice of both Dick Dastardly and Muttley. Mumbly was blue, and he was a detective. It was supposed to be funny, but it just wasn't. No. And it left me kind of flat.
Yeah.
And don't think after that I watched Saturday morning cartoons anymore, with the exception of course, the Bugs Bunny Roadrunner show, because that is, you know, Christians go to church on Sundays, Orthodox Jewish kids go to temple to go to shul on Saturdays. I would watch Bugs Bunny Roadrunner show.
Well,
it's part of religious upbringing.
Right, exactly. And see, what it was for me is there was a series that came out, and I don't remember exactly the chronology on this, but these are all within 2 years of each other. And the first time that I went, okay, this is all right because the characters work, but boy, these cartoons are really dumb, was Blue Falcon. Blue Falcon almost lost me. There was a Blue Falcon, and he had a German Shepherd dog that was his sidekick, and he was kind of an invented superhero that Hanna-Barbera, I think, put together right around 1977, 78. And then they insulted us with Jabberjaw, which was the giant shark cartoon. Yeah. And it was that guy who was the very last guy to join the Three Stooges. I can't even remember his name.
Joe Derita?
No.
Curly Joe?
No. It was after that. Maybe I'm thinking of something else. But either way, you'd know his name.
Prior to him was Joe Besser.
That's who it was. Joe Besser. I'll harm you. That guy.
Oh, I'll give you such a pinch.
Him, right. He was the one who did the voice of Jabberjaw, and it was horrible. And then it was either the year before or the year after Captain Caveman. And I thought,
I remember that. And then they bastardized that with the Flintstones on ABC.
Yep.
That was, you know what? It's funny. There was a point where you could actually start to pinpoint who had the crappy cartoons and who had the good ones. 9 times out of 10, it was always CBS had the winners.
Right.
Because they always started strong with Bugs Bunny at 8 o'clock, which usually was about 3 hours. So you had Bugs Bunny till 11, and then the other shows. And it would always end with the CBS Children's Television Film Festival, which was always kind of good. Right?
Yeah.
And also they would put it between it In the News, if you remember that.
Oh, loved In the News, yes.
So we had that, and when I was really, really young, you know, CBS always had things like Help, It's the Hair Bear Bunch. I wasn't a fan of Scooby-Doo, but they had Scooby-Doo,
right.
You know, except when they did the mysteries. And of course, Jerry Reed was on that episode of the mystery movie.
Sure.
The only thing that I kind of liked on ABC was Funky Phantom.
Funky Phantom was all right. Yeah.
And Mickey Dolenz was one of the voices on that show. But okay. The thing is that I didn't, you know, I don't, the only thing that I watched on NBC was the Pink Panther. And I really started to dig the Pink Panther when they had Mr. Jaws. Mr. Jaws was hysterical.
Oh, man. And the voice on the, on his little sidekick, the herring.
You and I, of course, have discussed this. Way years ago, we discussed this on Overnight America, and I even send you the one album that he released. Yeah. Arnold Stang as Irvin Catfish.
Irvin Catfish, yes, right. So I mean,
wearing
again,
a little bowler hat, and he looked Jewy too. He looked like a Jewish fish because yep. He had the baggy eyes and see now it's mysterious. But you know, and he wore the vest. But Mr. Jaws, Artie Johnson basically doing his character, his Nazi character from Laughing.
Right. Well, right.
Yeah, and very then, interesting, I think.
And then yeah. Not only did you have them, but you also had another just tremendously talented voice actor in John Byner, who was doing the Ant and the Aardvark. So he's doing the Jackie Mason voice for the Aardvark, and he's doing Dean Martin for the Ant.
And Dean Martin is, yeah. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
And those cartoons were hysterically funny. And then to round out the trio, because nobody on the actual Pink Panther cartoons talked, but the other one was the Inspector.
Did you know the very first Pink Panther cartoons, he actually did speak?
I do remember that. It's been a long time.
Around 1966... 1967.
And didn't he have
Peter Loftor?
Yeah, right. Okay, right. It was very smooth kind of delivery.
He was very smooth. He was a suave. He was a suave cat. But yeah.
But the Inspector.
But later on, when they brought back Pink Panther in like the late 90s, they had Matt Frewer doing the voice of Pink Panther, who's now like a house husband type of cat. You
Matt
know.
Frewer, who was Max Headroom, of course.
Max Headroom. Yes.
But
something
yeah.
completely unfunny. I didn't care about in the 80s.
Yeah, I love Max Headroom. But the Inspector cartoons were great because it was kind of their nod to, you know, the Pink Panther and Inspector Clouseau and all of that. But he did speak, and the guy who did not only the voice of the Inspector, but also the voice of the Sergeant Dudu, which was a great pun. Do you know who that was?
I don't remember.
That was Pat Harrington Jr. That was Schneider from One Day at a
no
Time.
Way.
Yes.
Guido Pizzini? Holy shit.
Yeah. And if you know, it's one of those things. It's like John Lennon singing Turn and Face the Strange in Changes. You don't register it, but then when somebody tells you, oh, yeah, that's John Lennon, you're like, of course it is. How did I not know that? Go back and watch those Inspector cartoons and you'll go, oh, of course it's him.
I'm sure because you're a media buff and history buff as I am. When Pat Harrington first came along, he did a character called Guido Pizzini, who he played on an episode of One Day at a Time, which was supposed to be Schneider's cousin.
Right.
Right. Nobody knew that he was Pat Harrington Jr., and they wanted to deport him. And they did the exact same thing to Bill Dana, who was known to everybody as Jose Jimenez.
Right.
I mean, how dumb do you have to be to see some guy on TV and go – let's deport him.
Okay. All right. Let's have the real argument then, because if we're going to talk about people playing their own cousins on TV, who's hotter, Samantha or Serena?
I'll take Samantha, actually.
Really? I'm a Serena guy.
But you know, when it comes to Genie and Genie 2, because Genie 2 never had a name, right. I'm still going to take Genie every time.
Yeah.
Cindy Dawson, are you listening? So therefore, you know, I'll still take the blonde. You know how I am. I like blondes.
You take the blonde, I'll take the one in the toy bin.
And you know what? Let me slip out of these dry, wet things and into a dry martini. Oh, feminine. The word is, well, it's bondage.
Oh, too much, man. Taffeta, darling. So that's it. Oh, do you watch, I don't know that we've ever had this conversation. Do you watch morning news TV at all?
Yes, I do. I watch morning news with my fingers on my holding my nose because it's just gotten so out of hand.
Oh yeah, but when they get away from the local news here in town, it happens at 7 o'clock. So I'm assuming that means in New York it happens at 6 a.m. when they go to the network stuff.
6 o'clock starts. What I usually do in the mornings is I have it flipped between. In New York, we have Channel 1, which is all news. It was originally Time Warner, now Spectrum. Channel News One, right? Okay. New York One. And it used to be just straightforward news, no funny stuff, no cutesy shit. Spectrum came in and made it cutesy. So now I just have to listen to irritating banter there as well, except they're not as astute in speaking as, let's say, for argument's sake, the folks on Morning Joe. So what I do is I leave the first 3 minutes of New York One on so I can get the facts, and I'm using the term facts loosely. Give me the weather, give me the rail and road reports, I'll know how the subways are operating, and let me get the hints. And then I flip over to Morning Joe so I can start my tirade, you know?
Yep.
Thankfully, Joe and Mika aren't there this week because they're on their honeymoon. They got married last week during Thanksgiving. I thought
they were already married.
No. They're just living in sin.
Oh, okay, good.
Married to other people and living in sin. You know how those people are.
Well, the reason I ask is because up until I lost my job, I kind of bring the conversation back down again. Right up until that happened, and by the way, there is movement on that front. I'll get to that in a little while. But right before that happened, I would always get up at 6:45, and I'd get 15 minutes of the local news, traffic, and weather, and then 7 o'clock would hit, and they'd go over to the national, you know, quote-unquote news. But for the first half hour of that, it actually is news, generally speaking. They cutesy it up a little bit because it's the CBS morning show. The reason why I watch the CBS morning show is the reason why they pay Stephen Colbert a lot of money. Because he's there for one reason and one reason only, so that when I have Channel 4 on when I go to sleep, it's still on when I get up. So that's what I'm always on, so I watch the CBS morning show. But I would only get about 15 minutes to a half hour of it before I would be up and out the door and on my way to work. Well, now, while I'm putting my YouTube show together... By the way, Inside the Box, John Grayson, check it out, subscribe.
There's a plug for you, folks, and I know because... I have appeared on that show.
Yes, you have.
We'll get to that later.
yeah, and I found out something funny about that, but I'll tell you about that in a little bit. So I have an hour and a half. Instead of 20 minutes to watch that show, I get about an hour and a half of it. And I don't know why Gail King is on the air, but I'm sick of her scolding me. What a pain in the ass that woman is.
I was trying to figure out why that came up in your thread on Facebook. And yeah, she's an irritation. And it's funny because she's as abhorrent to listen to when she's scolding people as Leah Dunham is to listen to her talking and moaning about how misunderstood but wonderful she is. Because there was an interview with her that came out that you had to see the thread. And I'm so happy and relieved that so many very, very reasonable, rational people all said the same thing. She's insufferable. Gail King is insufferable because Oprah let her be insufferable.
Right. Right. And having that power, having Oprah behind her, gives her a backdrop, a firewall. So she knows she's essentially bulletproof. So she can get on there and make her snippy little one line comments at everybody. And it's like, come on, lady, I don't need you to tell me what's funny, what isn't, what you think is acceptable in society and what isn't. Get over yourself and just read the news, maybe.
But John, the thing is, right now in society, that's what people, especially those who lean to the left, are like on a day-to-day basis, and especially on the news. They want you to have people out there telling you what to think, how to feel, what's funny, what's not, what to be angered by, who the enemies really are.
Yep.
And these are the same people that fomented the whole form of anti-Semitism on the left.
Right.
Notice how I brought it back to that.
Because they're always wagging the finger at you. You shouldn't do that. Oh, right. Yes. Yeah. So
these are the people who, they basically shit in your cereal at every turn.
Right.
Bung. You know, it's like that thing I brought up about Elsie and Elmer the cow. You know, a harmless, good-natured, laugh-filled conversation on Facebook with my old friends from Atlantic Records. When they were talking about Elsie the cow, I was like, and Elmer's glue, Elmer still rules. And another old friend of ours pops in with, well, Elsie was raped. And what?
Yeah, right.
Like, Jesus Christ. What to you? What went wrong? The thing is, the circuits have gone wrong with everybody on the left now. This is what people fail to understand across the boards. The left is no different than the right.
Right.
We keep talking about this divide in the country. There is no divide. It's a mirror reflection of each other.
Which is why they can't stand each other, because they know they're looking at themselves.
Right. Nobody listens. Nobody wants to actually engage in God help me, I'm going to use the phrase civil discourse.
Right.
Civility costs nothing, and yet at every turn it seems to cost people on the rational side of life their jobs or their reputation, their names, because you dared to cross these other people who know better than you.
Yeah. And one day, and I fully expect that one day it's going to happen that, you know, you and I are going to make a joke, or, you know, I'll be on the air somewhere and I'll make a joke or I'll say something that somebody will take the wrong way, you know, wrap it around exactly whatever agenda they've already got and start, you know, mounting some campaign to shut me up. And I already know what's coming because that's what life is like now. That's how it works.
Exactly. And you know what? To all of them, I say, you know how you take it straight up the ass. Fuck all of you. Fuck you. You want? Come get me. Come at me, bro.
That's
come
it.
At
me. Yeah, right. Let's do it. If somebody's going to start that fight, go ahead.
You want to go? Come on. Let's do this. Every cliche in the book, because I will not stand for it. I don't have the time and I don't have the patience. And no matter what, that's where I and you, not just you and I as a tandem, but we both elevate ourselves above this because we see it for what it is not worth. It isn't worth the time or the energy. Do you know how many arguments I've been mired in? And I'm using the term arguments loosely because you get these assholes who want to argue the cause for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. You know, she's this, she's that. And I'm like, have you sat and watched any of her? Oh, that's all you've got? That's a blah, 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 blah. I'm like, it seems to me all you want to do is troll and argue. But since we're on somebody else's wall, I'm going to bow out of respect to his wall and leave the conversation because you're obviously foaming at the mouth with absolute nonsense. All you like to do is spew verbiage and you love the sound of your own voice.
Right.
You're a dick.
Right.
Fuck off.
And I can't tell you how many times I've had to explain to somebody, you know, who will take a comment because sarcasm's difficult, especially in written form. It's not an easy thing to do. And I've made comments before and somebody that I know and have known for 20 years or more will snap back on me. And I'm like, ho, 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 man, what you think I just said is not what I just said. And that's the mode everybody is in, is if you disagree with me, and we've had this conversation before, if you disagree with me, you're insulting me. No. No, that's not what a disagreement is. My opinion on something is not an insult to your opinion. You can still have yours, you know, but recognize that there are other ways to look at things. That's what I'm doing.
That's certainly the kind of thing I was mired in when I tried to explain very nicely at first to this person. And I was like, that's your opinion and you're welcome to it. But obviously the person who posted this does not share your opinion. He and I share the same opinion.
Right.
And this guy was just not having it. And I'm thinking, you know what? There's no point. This guy just loves the sound of his own voice. But this is also somebody, because I looked at his Facebook page, his whole – you know how they have, you know, put a quote or something? Is like, if you don't want to sound like a fucking idiot, don't be a fucking idiot. Oh, aren't you classy? Keep it classy. All right there, bright boy. But the thing is, context is everything. And right. The fact that we always have to go before everything we say and say – folks, take this in context. There's always got to be a disclaimer now with everything you say, even in personal conversation.
Right.
You know, if you and I have a conversation about, you know, why REM sucked logs after Bill Berry left, you know we're going to hear it. Well, the facts.
Right.
Okay? Facts. Context. Before and after. And guess what? After 15 years, 16 years as a band, your recorded output starts to suck no matter who you are. If right. You would have stayed, they probably still would have sucked.
Yeah.
The bottom line is everything has its time and place. And there's nothing you and I can do to change how people are going to perceive things because they're so wrapped up in their own minds, their own self-centeredness, their own self-absorption. Sooner than later, people are going to start dropping like flies from heart attacks because the bullshit that they have put upon themselves because somebody else told them, that's the bullshit they need to carry. It's all going to come back to haunt them, and justifiably so. And to those people, I say, good. If you're going to die, do it now and decrease the surplus population. Because I don't have time or patience to pat you on the hand and say, there, it's okay. Because you know what? The one thing none of these people know how to say across the board, right or left, is, you know what? Maybe I was wrong.
Or you have a point. You know, that's another one. You never hear somebody say, well, you know what? You have a point. There's something, you know, I didn't think of.
I didn't think of it that way.
Yeah.
You know, maybe I should. Maybe I need to reassess this. It's not going to happen. That world is gone, and it's not coming. But you know why? This is the millennial world, and the millennial world. I'm telling you right now, and I said this to somebody yesterday. I look around and I listen to, because I work with a lot of millennials. They are not prepared for the real world as they get older. Nope. They're just not.
And that's our.
We have a generation. It's not completely. This generation that's coming up now is the generation of the idiots of the 90s. The idiots, especially like it, when I'll give you a perfect context to frame it from. You have these horrible shows that exploit, you know, unwed mothers. We are living in a society where there's absolutely no excuse, and I don't want to hear a single solitary excuse from anybody why girls at 15 and 16 are having kids. You can go anywhere and get free condoms. I don't want to hear that he doesn't right. want to use it. Then don't fuck if you're not going to use a condom. They're having kids. They don't have the skills that it takes to go out into the real world, you know? Even though they're being paid heaps of money to be on these shows, I'm presuming they're making money because they all have houses.
Yeah.
But these girls are dumb as bricks, okay? And all they're doing is having kids who have now grown. And these are these kids who were born of that kind of group in the 90s are now of an adult age. And they're idiots who don't have any preparation for life.
Right. Well, and it all goes back to the same thing. The idea that small, insignificant, meaningless things are things that you have to go to the mattresses over. And I don't know if I've brought this up to you before, but there was a thought that occurred to me because I was having this conversation with somebody a long time ago about how, you know, mountains are made out of molehills on a regular basis because I think part of it is we didn't grow up in adverse conditions. It's the same reason why there's such a thing as an anti-vaxxer movement. That level of stupid has to come from somewhere. And where it comes from is an entire generation of people who never had people in their class when they were in third grade die from polio, who never had people, you know, die from the measles, who didn't lose, you know, a fifth of their class by the time they were out of high school. We didn't have to deal with that stuff. So we go, oh, what's the big deal about vaccines? Well, you know, when half of the third graders used to die, they thought it was kind of a big deal. So in the same respect, we take little teeny things because we get bored and we take little teeny things and make a huge deal out of them and go out and carry signs and shit. And what occurred to me was, when I was in fourth grade, so my sister, who is 4.5 years older than me, would have been in ninth grade, her first year of high school. She brought home her books on the first day of school. And do you know what her history book was called in freshman? This is freshman high school history. She had a book called Problems in American Democracy. Do you know what would happen today if you were to give a high school freshman a book that said right there on the cover that there were problems with American democracy? Somebody would have a shit fit over that. It would never happen. And yet, that was what the book was about, is no system is perfect. Here's what's wrong with ours.
Yeah, but John, we're also living in a society that's trying to rewrite everything that is, you know, factually known to mankind.
Right.
Even something – now, people want to get into, you know, mired in these discussions, but they want to write like gender-neutral versions of the Bible. Yeah, right. You know, I'm not a Christian, but – you're going way too fucking overboard with this stuff. It's not for you. You don't. Here's a novel concept. If it's something that really doesn't affect you on a day-to-day basis, ignore it and mind your own fucking business.
Yeah.
How about that? I know that that's a novel concept, and I'm not saying that sarcastically. I'm saying it with anger because people stick themselves into things that they have no right to. Now, the thing with the anti-vaxxer movement, it is stupidity upon stupidity. It's part of the stupidity of the now generation,
right.
The conspiracy theorist lunatics. You know, you give a kid a vaccine, suddenly all of these kids have popped up and being autistic. A lot of kids are not autistic. You're projecting them to be autistic maybe because they have nothing to say. So because a child doesn't speak, suddenly he's autistic. You know what? If that was the case when I was a kid, I would have been definitely thought of as autistic. No, I was just a very quiet child who had nothing to say. As an only child, I was very much a solid, a solidary figure. Right. That was it. I was by myself, When I finally had something to say, I said it, you know. End of story. Not every child is autistic. Not and the fact is, what you're doing harms the greater good. So it's not about you, asshole.
Right.
Take your kid and get him vaccinated. Otherwise, don't come to school with your sick little kid.
Exactly. And if
but that's just one example.
But they keep changing the names. And the reason why there's been this quote-unquote big explosion in the number of kids who are diagnosed to be on the autism spectrum is because they changed the name. If you go back 15 years, and I remember this because my kid was one of them, they didn't say, oh, he may be on the autism spectrum. They said, he has ADHD. And before that, 15 years before that, he was hyperactive. And that's what the H in ADHD stands for. So they keep changing the name, and the diagnosis remains relatively the same. And, you know, and what do? Nothing really, but they change the name. And so all of a sudden you got all these kids who are being diagnosed as autistic. My son, by the way, who they tried to tell me when he was in first grade was ADHD, and I knew damn well he wasn't, is now married, has a son of his own, and has a great job and graduated college in 4 years with 3 degrees. So yeah, he's obviously hyperactive and can't pay attention anything for any length of time.
Well, I mean, when I was there, you know, if the diagnosis was done today on me as a child, it's obviously that, you know, he's a danger to society, and he has messianic complex, you know, tyrannical outbursts.
Yep.
He's going to be obviously a politician.
And here we are. But you know, it's
your malevolent dictator. Thank you.
And
thank
on,
you.
On the subject, by the way, of politics, our own malevolent dictator has been added again. It's been an interesting couple of days. So now Paul Manafort lost his plea deal because he decided to lie to Robert Mueller after he was given a plea deal. How big a schmuck do you have to be to lie to the guy, the one guy you can't lie to without extending your jail sentence?
Well, right. Manafort has shown himself time and again to be an asshole.
Right. And now Jerome Corsi is talking about going the same route and just continuing to lie his ass off and you know, refuse to cooperate with Robert Mueller. But the thing that was brought up briefly last night about Manafort, you know, going back and lying, is the only time that you would do that. There are two reasons that would justify it. And it's still, I mean, neither one of them is a particularly good reason. But if you look at it from his perspective, either the thing that he's lying about, the thing that he's trying to hide with the new lies, is so big and so damning and so unrelated to the earlier charges that he knows it would cost him the rest of his life in jail and take Donald Trump down with him. Or, considering the people that he was dealing with, he's convinced that if he tells the truth to Robert Mueller and it gets out that he's the one who blew in the Russian mob, they'll kill him.
Either way, he's a dead man. That's right. Number one. And number two, whatever he says about Trump, is there anything really that's going to, quote, bring down Trump? Because you've checklisted everything before from the time that Donald Trump became president.
Yeah, I know.
You know, so far he's not going anywhere. And I completely am in agreement with you the facts. You know, what we're going to do is we're going to sit here and watch the next 2 years roll by with the same shit day after day. Donald Trump's going to say stupid shit left, right, and center. There's just no way around it. He will not at any point change course.
Nope.
And if people think otherwise, that's the definition of insane. That's number one. Number two, It's going to, and because of that, we're going to have a Congress that's going to do nothing.
Yep.
Period.
Which is fine. I'm all about a Congress doing nothing. But the thing is, if the Democrats run Beto O'Rourke in 2020, they will lose to that schmuck again.
Absolutely. I can tell you right now.
And they're stupid enough to do it, by the way.
Well, in all seriousness, you know, any name that has been mooted to this point for 2020 on the Democratic side, they're all shit.
Yeah, they're all losers.
Bernie Sanders is, you know, I wish he would just drop dead already. Kirsten Gillibrand, she goes wherever the wind blows.
Yeah. Right, and he will torch her in a debate. He will make her look stupid in a debate.
He will make her cry in front of everybody, yep. And then he'll make fun of her while she starts crying.
Right.
Beto O'Rourke is a clown. Forget it. Cory Booker, he proved to me, never mind the things that I've seen since that I don't like him, that I've become to actually against him, He proved to me he's not ready for a center stage anyway. When he delivered the speech at the 2016 Democratic Convention, he's a very bad public speaker on a big physical stage. When he was the mayor of Newark, he was a miracle worker.
Yep.
No question about it. When he was, you know, he really should have stayed on a smaller scale, because he's not cut out for the big circus. He's just not.
No. And
he's much better on a local scale.
Well, right, exactly. But, and the reason for that is because he's an excellent administrator, and that's not what makes a good senator.
No. And here's the thing. Haven't we learned already? Don't have a senator as president. You're better off with somebody who's been a governor.
Right.
Governors make better presidents. Let's see. What senators have been presidents and sucked? Obama. I'm sorry. I think Obama was not a good president. He really wasn't. He was a nicer guy than Trump, but that doesn't make him a good president.
I think, and again, I'm a bigger fan than you are, but I think he was what we needed at the time. You know, we needed stability.
I completely agree with this, but George W. Bush, lousy president, lousy governor, nice man.
Yep.
Bill Clinton, horrible human being, fantastic president. He was. H.W., was he governor of Maine at any time?
No. No. In fact, outside of running the CIA, I'm trying to remember what he was voted into beforehand. And I don't think there was anything.
Well, then there you go. Lousy president.
Yeah.
Ronald Reagan, not a great guy, but he managed to parlay 8 years of religious fervor, and he was governor
right.
for two terms of California. Jimmy Carter, terrible governor of Georgia, even worse president. Gerald Ford, who? And then, of course, there was the former governor and vice president who became president. My favorite and yours. The one, the only. One Dick's Eye View. Tricky Dick himself. Bah. Yeah.
And yeah, I looked it up. Yeah, H.W. was only the CIA. Well, only. He was the director of the CIA. Before that, he was chief U.S. liaison to the People's Republic of China. But yeah, no elected positions until VP.
Interesting. Very interesting. Okay.
Oh, wait a minute. Oh, you go back far enough, you'll find it. Member of the U.S. House of Representatives from Texas's 7th District from January 1967 until January of 1971. So two terms as a representative, but it was 10 years before he was VP.
Interesting. Okay. I'll buy that. Prior to that, he was not governor of Texas. Was Lyndon Johnson governor of Texas? I don't remember.
Yes.
Was he here? Yeah, he was. Okay. Well, there you go. Great president. Massively misunderstood. Violently unappreciated. Why? Because it was the wake of the senator from Massachusetts.
Yep.
The senator that put income tax on Social Security.
Right.
Need I say more? Eisenhower was two-term president, but he was never elected to any office, was he?
No, he was just right, yeah, right out of the army. And by the way, I told you wrong. Lyndon Johnson was a senator. He was a senator from Texas, never governor.
Really?
Yep.
Okay. Well, there you go. There's one that completely belies the whole bunch.
Well, he's the exception that proves the rule. So I'm still with you on this one. But yeah, sure enough. And the thing is, you know, I wish there were a way to explode the mythology that goes with somebody like John Kennedy, because I've had this conversation with professors and people who were there, and I wasn't there, so I have no dog in this fight. It's just a point of curiosity for me, that if he had not been assassinated in November of 1963, would he necessarily have won the election in November of 1964? And of the people that I have asked that question to, the results are split almost down the middle. Half think absolutely, half of them think no flipping way.
You know, it's funny that you'd say that, because my thought is I think it would have been very, very close.
Yep.
Very, like, literally almost on the verge of a recount close.
It was the first time. I mean, without Chicago, he doesn't win.
Then again, would he have even gotten the nomination, depending on how well or poorly he was doing by late 1964.
Right, which would have depended a lot on what happened in Vietnam.
You mean French Indochina as he was escalating it?
Right.
See, these are the things that people don't talk about, but you and I know about. Why? Because we went to school and we studied these things and we learned about them. And these are called facts in history. And facts in history cannot be rewritten, people. And people want to rewrite history.
Right.
You know, well, it's just the way it goes sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody wants to make him a folk hero, which is, again, that's what we do. It's a very human reaction, but there were facts and there were things that were going on at the time. And he was not beloved, not by everybody.
Right. Well, my parents, who had been up until that point lifelong Democrats, when he put the income tax on Social Security, that made them switch parties.
Yeah.
So I think that says a lot. And probably we would not have had the Beatles had he not died.
Really?
You know, I know you've heard this story, but I'll relay it here. The day that Kennedy was assassinated, Brian Epstein was in New York City, finalizing a deal with Capitol Records to finally distribute the Beatles.
Okay.
He was actually with Billy J. Kramer because he was trying to get him signed over in the United States as well. And they were in the city, and suddenly, you heard people stopping and turning on transistor radios with the news that Kennedy had been shot. And Epstein's own words were, "That was the moment I knew the Beatles were going to become huge," because it was only 3 months later that they arrived in the United States.
Yep.
But 2 months later that "I Want to Hold Your Hand" was released here. And suddenly that diverted all the attention away from Kennedy and the Warren Commission and all that.
That's cool.
Another marathon that was on during Thanksgiving weekend on the EPIX channel was all the Death Wish movies leading up to the brand new one, the reboot. Now, I'll tell you something. I can sit there and watch over and over again that notorious scene in the first one. "I'm Paul Kersey. How's my wife?"
Yeah.
You know? I mean, Charlie Bronson was just stellar. Okay?
Yeah, and you know about the Led Zeppelin connection with those movies.
Well, Jimmy Page having done the music for 2 and 3.
And John Paul Jones did one of them, too.
Oh, God. obviously, after the first one, it was all downhill because they were just awful. But here's an interesting, funny little TV history trivia note for you. Okay. In the third one, the bad guy, the antagonist of this movie, is played by an actor named Gavin O'Herlihy.
Yep.
And I kept thinking to myself, why do I know that name? And then when I saw him up close, I said to Liz, "Do you know who that actor is?" And she goes, "No, who?" I said, "Did you ever watch Happy Days in its original form?" And she goes, "Yeah, why?" I said, "Do you remember the legendary Lost Cunningham, Chuck?"
Yeah, Chuck.
Because that's him.
The basketball player, Richie's older brother.
Yes. Richie's dumb older brother who always had like the big wad of gum and, the sliver. "Okay, see you later, Dad." That was him playing that movie. So this is now 13 years after his last appearance on Happy Days. So now we know where Chuck wound up.
Yeah,
Chuck
right.
Cunningham got shot by Paul Kurtz.
And who would have guessed anything different for him, by the way? those movies are so much fun to watch. And by the way, 3 minutes left to go in period number 3. San Jose and Buffalo are now tied at 2. So down to the wire looking for win number 10 in a row. But, all I can say is, here we go, Sabres. Here we go.
Here we go.
Now, a couple of things to wind up with, and I guess we can probably get to in our heads, and it's funny.
We got one more thing to talk about because we forgot this. This is kind of a bad thing to have forgotten. We forgot the passing of one of the greatest and most underappreciated guitarists ever, Roy Clark.
Yes.
We lost him a couple of weeks ago. We forgot to mention it. If you were a kid like we were in the late 60s, early 70s, you knew Roy Clark from his days on Hee Haw. And if you ever saw him play guitar, your mouth just dropped open, especially when he'd play Malaguena.
Yeah.
He was unreal. It was almost obscene because he just stood there poised and calm, always in a suit when he would do this. Just the spotlight on him, and his fingers would fly. He didn't move an inch. He didn't show any – all he would do was just stand there and smile with his eyes closed, and play that fucking thing like it was nobody's business.
Yeah.
He was a remarkable talent, and I mean remarkable talent. He was a great co-host in Foil to Buck Owens. It was a great show. I loved watching it. I loved the Hee Haw Honeys, of course. And, you know, it was always a shame that he never got the credit due him as being one of the – because he could play anything. He could play rock. He could play country, but – he was a motherfucker of a country guitarist on every level. When he played classical, out of the way.
Do you remember him playing Malagueña on the Odd Couple?
On The Odd Couple, no. I first saw him do it on the Mike Douglas show.
He did a guest appearance. That was the first time. Yeah, he did a guest appearance on The Odd Couple at one point, middle of the run, probably, 74, 75, and played that song on the couch, sitting on the couch, and Oscar and Felix are sitting on the chair opposite him, and he just goes at it, man. And it's clear that it was not, you know, they didn't set that up. It was, I mean, it was set up. It was supposed to be part of the show, but it wasn't... The audio equivalent of lip syncing. You know what I mean? He was really playing that guitar and just nailed it. I mean, nailed it hard. So, yeah, he was an absolutely amazing talent.
Just a phenomenal guitarist. And like I said, I loved Hee Haw. So, you know,
yeah,
that's another part of my childhood now gone. Yes, he was 85, but so what? He was still, you know, a major part of my kidhood.
And Misty Rowe is still out there somewhere. Huh. You know, I think she's still waiting for me.
You know who my favorite was? She was from one of the later Hee Haw. Well, Delta Burke was one of the Hee Haw Honeys, too.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But Mackenzie Cole. God, she was a goddess. Oh, man. And she's still gorgeous. So she now makes wonderful chocolates for a living. And Colt's Bolts, there's a treat for you.
Sounds like it. Oh, wait a minute. I've had those. I didn't know that was her.
Uh-huh.
Oh, nice. Okay, excellent.
Folks, if you don't know what Bolts are, they're like these giant, they're better than Reese's peanut butter cups because they're giant handmade milk chocolates with real peanut butter in them. So it's like, it's a peanut butter and chocolate sandwich. Forget sex. This is better.
And you're right. Yeah, she was a looker. Wow. But then again, yeah, like I said, they all were. So given that, let's, you know what, if we're in our heads this week, let's stay in that country realm for just a little bit, because we so often talk about pop and rock because it's where we live. But, you know, when it comes to country music, my introduction was, thankfully, because my dad is the coolest dude on the planet, was by way of Johnny Cash. It was one of very few country albums, and in fact he had that one on 8-track, the best of album, and it had Ring of Fire, and I mean just every great Johnny Cash song that you love was on this thing. It was a black label with white writing on the 8-track, and he used to play that thing in the Camaro all the time, and I just fell in love with every bit of that music. What was your introduction into country music, let's start there. What was your introduction into country music, and what did you first fall in love with in that genre?
My introduction to country music was around the age of 6 or 7 when WHN Radio, which we listened to, switched formats and became a country station. And my mother stuck with it, and she started to really get into it. And the first thing that I really, really genuinely – I mean, there were songs that I picked up on here and there that I liked.
Yeah.
But the first classic country song I fell in love with was probably 6 Days on the Road by Bobby Bear.
Yeah.
That was the shit.
I got me 10 forward gears and a Georgia overdrive. I'm taking little white pills and my eyes are open wide. I just passed a Jimmy and a White. Well, I'm a passing everything in sight. 6 days on the road, and I'm gonna make it home tonight.
And then, right after that, he put out Marie Laveau, the song about the New Orleans voodoo queen.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. So I became a big Bobby Bear fan pretty quickly. So in those years, because we only had an AM radio and the arguments would always go between WHN and WABC pop radio, if it was me and my cousins, we'd go back to ABC. If it was just me and my mother, we'd leave it on WHN. So, you know, there were things like, you know, Donna Fargo and obviously Conway Twitty and Loretta Lynn, Porter Wagoner and Dolly Parton as a duo. But the first thing that really hit home with me, I mean, truly hit home, was Red Sovine, the trucker's friend was his nickname, and a track called Teddy Bear.
Well, he gave me his address, and I didn't once hesitate, because this hot load of freight is just going to have to wait. I turned that truck around on a dime and headed straight for Jackson Street, 229. And as I rounded the corner, oh, I got one heck of a shock. 18-wheelers were lined up for three city blocks. Well, I guess every driver for miles around had caught Teddy Bear's call. And that little cripple boy was having a ball.
I don't even want to talk about it because I still get choked up to this day thinking about the song. He wouldn't sing. He would actually narrate.
Yeah.
The story. And Teddy Bear was about a little crippled boy who loved talking to the truckers on his CB. And I'm not going to talk about it because I'm starting to get choked off already.
I'm getting verklempt.
I mean, really, I hate talking about it. It's one of the most moving things I've – and for, you know, a kid to hear, it's like really overwhelming. But then Phantom 309, which was another of Red Sovine's big ones, another powerful moment. But then there were, you know, tracks like Tom T. Hall with things like I Like Beer and Faster Horses, Wild Women and More Whiskey, which a classic. Billy Crash Craddock. I mean, I just loved all of that stuff. One of my favorites was a dumb song called Country Bumpkin, which was kind of like the country version of Honey.
Right.
As in, and Honey, I Miss You. So that's – it's a tearjerker, but it's a great song. And then, of course, because I didn't make the connection until a little later on, Michael Nesmith and the First National Band brought me right back into the country music thing. So I really got into it all over again. By the mid-80s, funnily enough, my cousin Valerie had gotten into country music. So we would drive around listening to WHN before they changed formats and became the original WFAN All Sports Radio.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, but by the mid-80s, country was kind of turning into pop bullshit. You know, you had shit like Sawyer Brown and crap like that. But, you know, when I was a kid, country was still country. You know, we had Roy Clark's Yesterday when I was young. We had tons of things by Buck Owens and the Buckaroos, which had such great production, such a great sound to it. You know, just tons and tons of really wonderful things that came out of Nashville. I still have not been to the Grand Ole Opry, and that is definitely a place I want to go. So my love of country music is definitely one of those. It's been a lifelong thing. It's always been there.
Well, yeah, and I mean, before we even knew the term crossover, you know, crossover country, you know, pop hits and all of that stuff, you had Hoyt Axton writing songs for rock bands for 20 years, you know, and Hoyt's stuff was great. I mean, the stuff that he recorded himself, even if it was one of the songs that like Three Dog Night covered later on or something like that, his version of it had a soul to it that country music, as you said, starting in the mid-80s and going all the way through, lost completely. But the one thing that you said that I hooked onto is that you mentioned the humor involved in it. And that is what – the few times that I would listen to country music over my, you know, kidhood – into the, you know, the teenage years was when it was something funny. And that's why, as horrible a song as it is, Elvira makes me laugh. That song makes me...
What's about a horse?
I know.
That's fucking funny.
And it just makes me laugh. And there was another song right around that same time, just before country sort of lost its way. There was a song that my dad introduced me to, because if you looked at what was happening, Sabres scored, by the way, in overtime and won the game 3-2, 10 in a row. Nice well, job, boys.
Well done, Sabres.
But there was a song that came out as a reaction to Culture Club. And I mean, you think about country music in 1982 and 83 and what those guys would have thought of a band like Culture Club. And I mean, of course, you have things like the greatest country and Western song ever, you know, with I Was Drunk the Day My Mom Got Out of Prison, all the funny shit along the way. And it led up to this song called Where's the Dress by Mo Bandy and Joe Stanley.
Well, it's some old boy from England, Mo, and he's making $1 million.
Yo, we'll never make $1 million driving these old trucks.
Too many nights of drinking, losing football bets. Lately we'd do anything to get us out of debt. Where's the dress?
And it was funny, and it had an, you know, as edgy as country gets, it was getting there, you know, and those guys had a terrific sense of humor. There was another guy named Johnny Lutz Ritter, and from the same hometown as my wife, Lutz, Florida, which is spelled Lutz, but it's pronounced Lutz, and he did a song called Beautiful Downtown Lutz. And there was nobody in Lutz at that time. There were like 25 people who lived there or something, and had a little minor country hit with this thing, with Beautiful Downtown Lutz in probably 1980 or 81. And so, again, it was always the goofy shit
that got
my attention.
Well, funnily enough, you know, as I said before, I was a big fan of Bobby Bear. He had this great song called The Winner, which is about getting the shit kicked out of him. You know?
Yeah, right.
You know, and I had 7 broken bones, but that made me the winner. I mean, that was funny shit like that. Or of course, one of the all-time greats, Jim Stafford, Spiders
yes.
and Snakes, you know?
Yep.
Now, I know this ain't meant to be funny, but Convoy was fucking hysterical. It's so over the top. I mean, for God's sakes, it even spawned a movie.
Right.
It was the dark of the moon on the 6th of June in a Kenworth pulling logs. Cab over Pete with a reefer on and a Jimmy hauling hogs. We is heading for Bear on I-10 about a mile out of Shaky Town. I says, Pigpen, this here's a rubber duck and I'm about to put the hammer down.
And you had those guys who were essentially clowns. You know, that was their act, is that they're going to go out and sing funny country songs. But they were all great at it. And those songs, I mean, even Spiders and Snakes and the other Jim Stafford stuff, you know, they were good, solid songs, and they were funny. Who was the other guy? Not the one who did the streak, not Ray Stevens. Although he had a bunch of them. But there was...
Yeah, I mean, Ray Stevens' stock in trade was comedy. The only time... I mean, obviously, Guitarzan and Ahab the Arab, and of course, The Streak. But he also had that god-awful song, Everything is Beautiful.
Right. Oh, right.
That's like, you betrayed everything. Yeah. That's what you did.
But, you know, he also did the Mississippi Squirrel Revival, which is hilarious. And there was a guy that would do, occasionally he would do songs, but he did mostly spoken word stuff, named Jerry Clower, who really embodied that same kind of space that Ray Stevens carved out, and, you know, would spin the yarns and talk about down-homey kind of stuff. And it was always just a little bit twisted, you know, just enough not to piss off any of the country audience, but still, you know, it had a little bit of that edge to it, and it was great.
We definitely have to bring out a couple of the things, you know, since I was growing up during this period, we have to bring up, of course, the one and only Jerry Reed.
Definitely. Because
you cannot talk about country without bringing up Jerry Reed. And of course, two of my favorite songs from that era were from, of course, the group known as the Outlaws.
Uh-huh.
And that would have been Waylon, Willie, Tom Paul Glazer, and Jesse Coulter, who was married to Waylon Jennings. Waylon and Willie doing Lookin' Back Texas.
Yep.
And, of course, Good Hearted Woman.
She's a good hearted woman in love with a good time and man. She loves him in spite of his ways she don't understand. Through teardrops and laughter, the this world hand in hand. A good hearted woman loving a good time.
And that album, The Outlaws, that is just a fucking life changer. The original one where it's this great artwork, because, you know, country music really didn't take its cues from the outside world, you know, even visually speaking, you know, when albums started to have great artwork. but they took that one and they made it great because it looks like an old Wanted poster, as it should be.
Right.
You know? And that was just a monster album. I mean, Jesse Coulter had that great campy song called I'm Not Lisa. Oh, it's hysterical. It's so bad. It's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. But the great thing was in that period, in the 70s, especially for country, I mean, everything that came out was 90% good.
Yeah.
And it stayed with you for life. You know, one of my favorite upon favorites was Billy Swan's I Can Help, which was just a neat song. Yep. And catchy as fuck. And I think it ranked very high on the Billboard pop charts too. You know, I mean, that just went sailing up the pop charts. So, you know, we grew up in a time when country music really had it really had it right, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's good exploring it with you as always. And of course, the comment section exists on this page so that you can toss in your own.
We cannot close the show because you said you had an update for us.
Oh, on the job front, yes. Okay. I can't say where it is at the moment because I don't know that it's been announced that it's open.
Let me play devil's advocate and interviewer here for a moment, Mr. Grayson. Can you at least say for the audience and to me as the interviewer, is there something at least, is there an iron in the fire?
There is. In fact, there are several. So I've had a couple of conversations with people that I know. And out of nowhere, I called a buddy of mine who lives in a town where there is a radio job open that I applied for. And I said, do you know anything about this radio station? Because I knew some, but not very much. And he said, yeah, I kind of know him because he worked for their competition for a while. So he said, I know them, but I really only know them as the enemy. You know, I don't. They're a fine radio station, but they're the second tier one in town. So you'd be better off going with the other one, but they really don't have anything available right now. Well, that same guy called me back today and he said, you know, as soon as I said that, I thought maybe I should call over there and see if there's anything going on. And sure enough, there is kind of, there's an evening show that is not technically open right now, but there's also really nobody doing the job right now. Not full time anyway. And so he called their program director, and now she's very interested in me. And we've had a couple of email conversations back and forth leading up to a phone call that may very well be a game changer. So, like I said, I can't say where it is or even allude to it because it's not technically a listed job yet. But
folks, it's DC-101. He's taking Howard Stern's old job.
Yeah, right.
Ba-ba-booey. Ba-ba-boo.
But yeah, with any luck, by the time we talk next week, I'll have at least a little more direction as far as that one is concerned.
Well, I applaud that wholeheartedly.
It's nice to have friends.
You know, it's what's a good way to get really big ratings, or ratings through the roof when you get back on the air? Make a woman have sex on the radio.
Yeah, I've heard that works.
Tell her to sit on a subwoofer. Ooh, yeah.
Not really my shtick, but all right, man. Well, listen, have a wonderful rest of your week, and we'll get back together and do this all again next time. What do you say?
Absolutely, my friend. Have a great week, and as always, thank you to everyone listening. Hope everybody had a wonderful holiday, and just try to take it a little easy, folks. You know, the holidays are coming up. Focus on the good things, because this too shall pass. Like a kidney stone, this too shall pass.